planning the topics for this conference, they decided on the topics that they wanted to speak on, and so when asked me to speak on, and I think it was 2-3, maybe a few more weeks after that, that Andrew contacted me and said, "Team would like you to do one more. Would you do one on grieving in community?" So that's what we're going to talk about this evening. And I've titled it Grieving Well, Grieving Together. The gift of presence in times of heartbreaking loss. When my wife, Karen, died, I knew that I needed to face my loss completely and grieve. I knew that. So one of the things that I did was I attended a grief group. And one time, during one of those grief groups, a man came who had just lost his wife a few days previous to coming to the group. And I knew that it was going to be very difficult for him because his loss was so fresh. And I was shocked, though, by what I heard and what I saw. Instead of heartache, this man was smiling and beaming. And he smiled all the way through that evening as he talked about the death of his wife and the victory in Jesus. He was celebrating as if he had just gotten married rather than as his wife had just died. And it saddened me to see no grief. The following Sunday, this man sang a solo in his church, and he beamed as he sang the solo. And several people commented about how strong and brave he was for singing so soon after his wife's death. Where was grief? About 2 weeks later, he made an announcement that he was getting married again. Where was grief? Was it victory in Jesus? Or was it a denial of reality? While the situation that I've just described may be extreme, it's also reflective of our society. We have moved toward celebration rather than grieving our losses. Alistair Begg said that we as a society have become fundamentally dishonest when it comes to grief. This year, Karen and I would have celebrated our 50th wedding anniversary. Jody and Joe would have celebrated their 48th anniversary this year. Instead, Jody and I are celebrating our second next month. We've experienced heartbreaking loss, and reflecting back on our journeys of grief have given us much to ponder about loss and grief. One of the things that stands out to me is that we as a society have lost touch with the significance and importance of grieving in times of heartbreaking loss. Instead of grieving, we focus more on celebration of life. We talk about Christ's victory over death. And when tears and heartache come, we're encouraged to celebrate that our loved ones are in a better place. They're absent from the body and present with the Lord. We smile and we try to skip over the loss and grab the joy and the celebration which is to come. But in doing so, we push the ache in the heart away. We push the gift of grief away. Ecclesiastes tells us that there's a time for everything. There's a season for every activity under heaven. There's a time to weep and a time to laugh. There's a time to mourn and a time to dance. There's a time to be silent and a time to speak. There is a time for celebration, but we in our society have tended to diminish the time to weep and the time to mourn. One of the consequences is that we become a little more disconnected with our own hearts, and that impacts the way we connect and relate to people. Connections become more superficial, relationships more shallow. We're no longer truly with people in their times of heartache and loss. Well, what I've described is a general tendency in our society. It's not reflective of everyone, nor is it representative of all cultures within our society. For example, I've observed firsthand that our Alaska Native culture typically approaches grief more honestly and enters grief more readily than does much of our white culture, of which I'm part. In the 80s, I had a counseling office in Glen Allen and Faith Hospital. And one of the things that I did is I was often there when tragedy happened. And when the ambulance was sent out, they called me so that I was at the hospital waiting for when the ambulance arrived. And there were lots of tragic things, from aircraft accidents to automobile accidents to abuse, suicide, the whole gamut. And when the ambulance was set out, I would be there waiting for when it came back. Sometimes I was with the patient. Sometimes I was with the family. And I'd like to recount for you two situations that happened relatively short, in short duration, to each other. The first was a young Native man who had attempted suicide, and he was not expected to live. Within a short time of the ambulance arriving, people began to arrive from Copper Center, Galkana, Chistochina. Pretty soon, people were coming from Iklutna, Chickaloon, Mentasta, and even as far away as Cantwell. The waiting room was filled with people. It wasn't clinic time, but the waiting room was full. And the parking lot was full of cars and people hanging out, waiting, being with the family. Very short time in that time frame. The second situation was a young woman who attempted suicide and was not expected to live. Soon after the ambulance arrived, her husband came. The next day, her sister came from Anchorage. The waiting room was empty. The parking lot was empty. Those two cases demonstrated to me a sharp contrast between two cultures in their manner of dealing with loss and grief. And I observed that contrast many times on such occasions. This has led me to believe that many non-Native Americans are not very good at grieving. Sometimes we try to avoid it. Sometimes we try to get past it as quickly as we can. And I'd like to suggest that we can do better than that. We can face our losses and grieve and come out the other side with a greater reliance on God, with a greater maturity, and with a more tender heart that engages with others and loves others well. During these past 4.5 years since the death of my wife, Karen, I've also been paying much more attention as I read through the Bible and as Jody and I read every day. I've been paying more attention to the themes of grief, and I've been writing down for over 4 years now things that I've noticed as on the topic of grief. And pondering this has caused me to become more curious about the culture understandings and expressions of grief within Judaism. And once again, I've been struck with a glaring contrast between how they deal with it and how we generally do. In Judaism, there are several distinct structured stages that a practicing Jew follows in the grief process. The first is known as Ananut. It's a time of intense mourning, and it's a time period from the time of death until burial. And during this period, the mourners are relieved of all responsibilities, and their only focus is to grieve and prepare for the funeral and the burial. All attention is focused in that direction. After, well, there's also a what's called kriya, or a tearing of the garment, that they do during that time also. And it signifies a tearing of a hole in the fabric of life. Then there's a second stage called Shiva. And if you know anything about it, you might have known people who have said they're sitting Shiva. Any of you familiar with that? It's a 7-day period. And during this period of time, it's also a time of very deep grief. And the grievers will sit at home, and they sit on small stools and grieve. And again, they're relieved of all responsibilities. Visitors come. They come to be with them, to grieve with them, but there's specific instructions for them also. They're not to pull the mourner away from their grief. They're to support them in it. And the visitors will come and sit with them, but their focus is on the griever and what the griever most wants. If the griever wants to sit in silence, they sit in silence with them. If they want to reminisce, they reminisce with them and share some memories and stories. The visitors are never to distract from the grief. They're to be there with them. Neither are they to force mourning. They're to take their cues from those who are grieving. During this time period, the mourners are also reminded that they don't have responsibility for providing refreshments for the guest, or to even be responsible for engaging in conversation with them. They're relieved of those responsibilities as well. The visitors bring the refreshments. When the 7-day period of mourning is over, they shower, change their clothes. I didn't tell you that they don't even shower or change their clothes this time. They're just grieving. Then they shower, change their clothes, and start to engage in life again. But the visitors and friends are reminded to stay in contact with them, knowing that some of the most difficult struggles of grief and loss will happen later. And then there's the third stage called Shloshim. This is a 30-day period, which is extended to the year in case of parents, the death of a parent. During Shloshim, the mourner starts back to work, but does not fully engage in the world. Things like concerts or parties or public entertainment are avoided during this whole period of time. It's a gradual reentry back into life. And at the close of the first year, there's often a memorial service, which could include several speakers, music, poetry, and other memories, just honoring the deceased. After this period is over, the mourners are more free to fully engage in the community and into communal worship. And yet there's still special times that are set apart for reflecting on the deceased. So in other words, it's Yarzit, which means time of year. That's the anniversary of a loved one's death. And that's often a time when they do some activity that they remember the one that they lost. And it could be going on a hike or cooking a favorite recipe of the deceased. But doing something together that's remembering and honoring the person who is deceased. Well, these Jewish traditions and guidelines provide a formal structure for grief. It's not that grief is contained within that structure, but rather it's that the structure aids the grief. It helps the mourners recognize the importance of deeply facing the impact of the loss, as well as the importance of gradually integrating back into life. Grief and remembering continue on, and it gets incorporated into life. I think that these Jewish stages for grieving offer a structure that may help those who embrace it to recognize both the importance of grieving and continuing on in life. In writing about grief and loss, Jerry Sitzer said it well. He said, "The supreme challenge to anyone facing catastrophic loss involves facing the darkness of the loss on the one hand and learning to live life with renewed vitality and gratitude on the other." When we don't grieve well, it impacts the way we relate to others. When I was a child, Bob Grover was my pastor. Pastor Bob's family and mine spent a lot of wonderful time together. And shortly after Bob left the pastorate, my mom died. Many years later, I met up with Bob and his family, and it was really a good time to reconnect and to reminisce. And during the course of the conversation, Bob's wife turned to me and said, "Did you know that your mom was my very best friend?" I said, "No, I didn't know that." She said, "Yes. She was my very best friend, and when she died, it was really hard on me, and I vowed that I would never open my heart up to another person like that again, because it hurt too much when she died." My heart sunk when I heard that. To protect herself from the pain, she made a conscious decision to close off her heart to deep, meaningful relationship. Many years later, when Karen was unconscious in the last days of her life, a pastor from the Denver area where we were in a Lakewood hospital called me and he says, "You don't know me, but I'm the grandson of Bob Grover." He said, "I'm a pastor in this area. I'd like to come and visit you." And I said, "Sure. Come and visit." And we visited for a while, and I related the story that I just told you to him. And he replied, "Grandma was always so cynical and not very open to letting people get close to her." When we grieve, when we avoid grief, it impacts our heart. When Karen died, I knew that I needed to grieve. Having worked in the counseling office for many years, I saw the consequences of attempting to ignore and shove grief away. And now this young pastor had come and provided a very fresh reminder to me that I didn't want my heart to become calloused or numb. I wanted my heart to remain tender in the midst of heartbreaking, crushing loss. And I knew that for that to happen, I would have to face my loss completely, not distract myself from it. I needed to feel whatever emotion came up and experience it fully. I needed to allow it full expression to reveal deeper things in me and deeper things about my loss. I pictured it like a path. And this picture came to me just immediately after Karen died. There's a path that had a ditch on two sides. On one side was a ditch of distractions. And almost anything can be a distraction to pull you away from feeling the grief and the loss, the heartache. But I knew that I must not give in to the distractions. It didn't mean that I wouldn't live life and do things. It simply meant that I was going to consciously attempt to not let them be a distraction that would pull me away from fully facing my loss. On the other side of the path, I pictured a path of self-pity. It could be very tempting to fall into the ditch of self-pity. So for me, I had a path that was in front of me. Both ditches could lead me away from fully facing the impact of my loss. I knew that I needed to stay on the path. It meant many, many tears for many months. But I knew what I needed to do. But in addition to knowing what I needed to do, I also knew why. The reason I need to stay on the path and feel the full impact of the loss is because I want my heart to be free to both give and receive love. If I tried to keep away from the ache, I would at best numb my heart a little to feeling the loss. At worst, I would harden my heart and it would become calloused. The damage that results is the diminished ability to give and receive love. In order for my heart to remain tender, I must choose willingly to feel the ache of the loss and grieve it fully. It's more about having a tender heart that's free to love than it is about whom to love. It's whomever God brings into my path. It might be a family member, a friend, or it might be the clerk at the grocery store. It always involves being free to receive love from God and to love Him in return. And my love for God always involves the way that I relate to others and love them. Jesus said it clearly when he said, "If you love me, you will keep my commandments. And my commandment is this, that you love one another." So the way that I show my love to God is the way that I connect and love others. And I cannot love God the way he's asking me to if my heart is numb or calloused. So my path has been clear, but that doesn't mean it's painless. It's just clear. I know what I need to walk, and I know why I need to walk it. It's painful and not easy, but I have direction and I have purpose in the midst of heartbreaking loss. Grieving helps us to incorporate painful losses into our life. Those whom we lost remain an important part of our lives. Life goes on, though there are many times in the midst of gut-wrenching heartache that if we're honest, we don't want to go on with life without the one we lost. At those times, it's even possible that we may wish our own life would end rather than continuing on. But life goes on. And attempting to minimize the loss by ignoring the pain may have the undesirable effect of separating our hearts from both ourselves and from others. Additionally, it can also separate ourselves from deep, honest relationship with God. One of the means of that separation can come from resorting to unhelpful platitudes about God. It's then that we're more apt to talk about God than to talk to Him. The Old Testament book of Psalms has many psalms of lament. And they teach us the path of being brutally honest with our losses and talking to God about them. Not talking about God, but rather talking to Him. Expressing all of the rawness that we're experiencing. Trying to move quickly past the loss separates our heart from ourselves, from others, and from God. We've already been separated from the one who died. And when we shove grief away, we add to the separation by trying to move quickly past the grief as though grief is the problem. We're all familiar with phrases like healing from grief, recovering from grief, but grief is not the problem. Grief is not something that we heal from. Grief is a gift that helps us to incorporate significant and painful losses into our life. Oh, it's painful, but grief is something to be experienced and felt deeply. Grief brings connection in a time of loss and separation. When Karen died, I was separated from her presence. Karen and I were married for over 45 years, and she was the most significant person in my life. She was the one who was always with me. And when she died, I lost her presence. The last words in the eulogy that I wrote for Karen were this: "So now, Karen, since your presence is no longer in my presence, but in the presence of your Lord, I simply say, we journey on, my love." Little did I know the significance of those words when I wrote them. Death brings the loss of presence, and the loss of presence awakens a deep sense of aloneness. At the conclusion of the memorial service for Karen at Community Covenant Church in Eagle River, Pastor Mark addressed the audience, and he said, "It's not good that man should be alone." And I choked and nearly burst into sobs. Those words penetrated a very deep place in my heart. It is not good for man to be alone, and I'd just lost the one who was always with me. Mark was reminding others that it's important to be with me. It's not good for man to be alone. That's something that God pronounced in Genesis 2:18, after he made man. He formed Eve from Adam's rib and brought her to him. And it's significant that God said, it's not good for man to be alone before sin ever entered into the world. Aloneness is never good. Death reminds us of our aloneness and our hunger for presence. And my little story of aloneness and the loss of presence is part of a much bigger story of the loss of presence. The loss of presence goes all the way back to the Garden of Eden, when man chose disobedience to God, and the result was a loss of presence. Sin brought separation, death, and aloneness. Not only do we grieve the loss of presence, but God also grieves the loss. In Genesis 6:8, it says that when man saw God saw the wickedness of man, he grieved and his heart was filled with pain. God grieves. And when he grieves, he moves towards us to be with us. He sent his son to crush the head of the serpent who sneaked death into the garden so that we could once again enjoy the presence of God without sin causing separation. Furthermore, Jesus suffered the loss of presence in the process of conquering death. Jesus had always been with the Father since the beginning of time. But on the cross, he cried out, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Jesus experienced the most significant and agonizing loss of presence imaginable. He did it so that he could make it possible for us to once again experience unbroken presence with him and with all who put their trust in him. He conquered death, and when he comes again, he will gather us together to be in his presence forever. In the meantime, God has promised to be with us. My personal story of grief and loss, the loss of presence, gets incorporated into God's bigger story of grief and the ultimate redemption that restores presence that will never again be lost. So if that's the way the story ends, shouldn't we just skip over our grief and celebrate what's coming? No, not at all. The reason is that my story and your story has not yet ended. We are to live out our story in the context of God's larger story. You may recall the Old Testament story of Joseph, one of the 12 sons of Jacob. Joseph had to live out his story. It was a story of betrayal, abandonment, abuse, slavery, false accusations of rape, and an unjust prison sentence, and then being forgotten. We're told that Joseph's brothers saw the terror in his eyes when they were planning on killing him. They ended up selling him into slavery instead. Joseph's experience was distressing and horrifying, and he didn't know how his story was going to end. Yet three times in that narrative, we're told this phrase, God was with Joseph. God didn't just point to the end of the story and tell him that it would all work out for a greater good. Instead, he was with Joseph in the heartache. He was with him in the pain. And eventually Joseph did see and understand that God indeed was working for a greater good in the midst of the pain and the unjust treatment. But that realization didn't come till much later in the story. God gave Joseph the gift of his presence in the painful and unjust part of his story when he didn't know how it was going to end. Moses also had to live out his own story. It was not an easy story. But Moses knew the significance of God's presence with him as he lived it out. On one occasion, Moses said, "If you're pleased with me, teach me your ways so that I may know you and continue to find favor with you. Remember that this nation is your people." The Lord replied, "My presence will go with you, and I will give you rest." Then Moses said to him, "If your presence does not go with us, do not send us up from here." Moses knew the significance of God's presence with him and with his people, Israel. In Isaiah, God promised that he would send his son into the world, that his name would be called Emmanuel, God with us. And when Jesus gave his final instructions to his disciples, he concluded with, "And surely I am with you always, to the very end of the age." The disciples still had to live out their stories. Stories that were filled with heartache and pain, as well as joy. And Jesus reminded them he would be with them. God promises to be with us as we live out our own stories as well. He grants us the gift of presence, especially in those times when we feel very alone. The biblical story that perhaps brought the greatest comfort to me after Karen's death was the story of Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead. It's the story of Jesus being with his friends during the time of heartbreaking loss. When Jesus first heard about the death of Lazarus, the Bible says that he was deeply moved. He felt the full impact of the loss. He didn't say, well, you know, he's in a better place now. Nor did he say, he's dancing in heaven now. He didn't say, don't cry, I'll raise him from the dead. In John 11:33, it says, when Jesus saw Mary weeping and the Jews who had come along with her weeping, he was deeply moved. Jesus let the rawness of the moment impact him. And moments later, we read the words, Jesus wept. And still later in the story, when they took him to the tomb where they laid him, it says, again, Jesus was deeply moved. When someone's deeply moved, you know it. There's no hiding it. Jesus was deeply moved. He was with his friends and grieved with them. Isaiah 53 tells us that Jesus was acquainted with grief. He didn't spit out platitudes, nor did he stuff his grief. Neither did he jump to the future hope of resurrection, although he fully anticipated it. But in the moment, he saw their grief and was deeply moved. He entered the grief with them, and he himself grieved. This is Jesus, the one who knows something about resurrection. He was about to raise Lazarus from the dead. This is Jesus, the one who said that he would rise from the dead and conquer death. This is Jesus, the one who gives us hope of resurrection because he rose from the dead. This is Jesus. He is the resurrection and the life. And I want to reiterate it once again. When Jesus encountered his friends who had just lost their friend and brother through death, he was deeply moved. He entered their grief and grieved with them. In my own grief, the ones who helped me the most were the ones who saw my grief, and they were deeply moved. They didn't try to pull me out of my grief or soften it by saying that Karen's in a better place now, even though it's true. She is in a better place. They simply grieved with me. They were present with me. They were with me in my grief. People who are with me in my grief help me to get a glimpse of the heart of God. God sees my grief, and he's moved with compassion. He knows my pain, and that's comforting. I am not alone in my grief. Their presence and their sharing in my grief help me to feel the full impact of the loss and just let the tears flow. And when I chose not to censor the rawness of what I was feeling with friends who cared to hear it all, I did experience a very small, slight lifting of the heaviness. Oh, it still hurt deeply, but it was lighter than experiencing it completely alone. It's not good that man should be alone. The experience of genuine, caring presence of people who reached out to me, touched my heart deeply. Sometimes I didn't know what to say, but that was okay. It's not the person's words so much as it is their presence that touched the deepest. They're entering the grief with me and bringing their caring presence. It stood in stark contrast to people who didn't know what to say, but attempted to distract me from the grief or pull me out of it. Some changed the subject. Others offered mere platitudes meant to ease the pain. And though some platitudes even contained some truth, they didn't bring any comfort. They were spoken to lessen or distract from the grief rather than entering the grief with me. So I began by saying that we as a society in large have lost touch with the significance and the importance of grieving in times of heartbreaking loss. You and I have grown up in a society that tries to anesthetize pain. My dad was also a product of that mentality. When my mom died, I was 13. 4 months later was our first Christmas together without mom. And my dad and my brother and I were not looking forward to that first Christmas without mom. But we talked about it and we decided that we would do as we always did. We would have our evening meal and then we'd go into the living room and we'd open presents together. That meal was a hard one to get through. And then we got up, cleared off the table, and the three of us walked towards the living room. And my brother and I turned to go into the living room, and my dad turned the other way and went into his bedroom and closed the door. And my brother and I sat and waited for my dad to come, but he didn't come. And after a significant time of waiting, I got up and went to my dad's bedroom door, and I knocked on the door. And I said, "Dad, are you coming?" And he said, "Yeah, just a minute." And we went back and we waited. After another long time of wait, I went back and knocked on the door again. I said, "Dad, are you coming?" He said, "Yeah, just a minute. I just need a little more time." And we bent back and waited. And I don't remember how many times I went back and knocked on the door. But I remember very well the last time that I went back. I said, "Dad, are you coming?" And he said, "No. You boys just go ahead without me." I got a lump in my throat, and I returned to the living room, and I didn't want any presents. I sat there for a while, and finally I picked up a present, and I ripped the side off of it, and I pushed it away. I didn't want presents. I wanted my dad to be with us. I wanted him to come out and throw his arms around us and say, "I miss her too." And then just cry together. We didn't want Christmas presents. We wanted the presence of our dad. It was a time to grieve, but we stuffed our grief and became a little calloused and a little angry instead. In the movie Shadowlands, C.S. Lewis gave me a vivid picture of what I wanted from my dad. C.S. Lewis had just lost his wife to death. His stepson was about the age that I was when I lost my mom. And in one scene, C.S. Lewis and his brother are walking, and his brother says to him, "You need to talk to the boy." And C.S. Lewis responds and says, "I don't know what to say." And his brother says, "Talk to him. Just talk to him." And then this is the next scene.
"Hi."
"Hi."
"When my mother died, I was your age. I thought that if I prayed for her to get better, and if I really believed she'd get better, then she wouldn't die. But she did."
"It doesn't work."
"No, it doesn't work."
"I don't care.
I loved your mother very much. Perhaps I loved her too much. She knew that. She said to me, 'Is it worth it?' She knew what it would be like later. Doesn't seem fair, does it?"
"I don't see why she had to get sick."
"No, nor me. But you can't hold on to things, Douglas. You have to let them go."
"Jack."
"Mm-hmm."
believe in heaven?
Yes, I do.
I don't believe in heaven.
That's okay.
I sure would like to see you again.
C.S. Lewis entered the boy's grief, and he grieved with him. He was fully with him. That's what I wanted from my dad when my mom died. In my dad's defense, he was also hurting deeply. And he was likely trying to protect my brother and me from being unsettled by his pain and his grief. He's trying to be strong for his boys, which likely meant not crying in front of his boys. But that's not what we needed. We needed his presence to be in our presence so that we could grieve together our shared loss. Grieving doesn't diminish the loss. Instead, it helps us to incorporate the loss into our lives, and it helps us to keep our hearts open to both giving and receiving love. When we're with someone in their greatest heartache and pain, it's at those times when they're most keenly aware of their aloneness, we have the opportunity to bring them the gift of presence. Ultimately, another person's presence awakens me to the greater realization that God has promised that he would never leave me. I am not alone. He is with me. Grieving well, grieving together. Grieving keeps the aching heart open to giving and receiving love. Grieving with others brings a taste of presence in a time of unspeakable aloneness. Yes, we have the promise of God's ultimate victory over death, and it will result in being restored to his presence that will never, ever end. But in the meantime, we are to bring the gift of presence to others. Our presence with them will give them an hors d'oeuvre. The banquet will come later. Our presence is the hors d'oeuvre. It provides the precious gift of presence in a time when presence has been lost. It's not good that man should be alone.